Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. British voters head to the polls Thursday for what has been called the most important vote of their lifetimes, whether the United Kingdom should stay or leave the European Union. Wednesday was the last day of campaigning. Prime Minister David Cameron, speaking in Birmingham, urged voters to cast ballots to remain in the EU.
There is no going back. If we leave the European Union, we can only rejoin if we wanted to rejoin and join for the first time the Euro, the Schengen no borders system, and give up the British rebate. That would never happen. So this vote, if we leave, is irreversible.
Former London Mayor Boris Johnson, among the Leave campaigners, said voting to stay in the EU would be like being locked in the back of a car, going in the wrong direction with no hope of changing.
This is the last chance I think our country has to take back control of obviously a lot of money, which is important, of our immigration system, which is also important, but basically of our democracy.
Two polls just before Thursday's referendum showed a slight advantage to the Leave campaign, although there are still many undecided voters. In Democratic Republic of Congo, opposition presidential candidate Moise Katumbi was sentenced in Kinshasa in absentia to 3 years in prison, fined $1 million after being convicted of selling a house he did not own. Katumbi, who is currently receiving medical attention in Europe, has denied the charge. He also said a separate charge that he hired mercenaries in a plot against the state is also aimed at derailing his bid to unseat President Joseph Kabila in the elections expected in November. A government spokesman denied there's any political connection. The sentence effectively bars Katumbi from standing for public office. This is VOA News. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is quoted by official media Thursday as saying Wednesday's tests of medium-range ballistic missiles means his country possesses the sure capability of attacking U.S. interests in the Pacific. While the first missile launch was deemed a failure, the second reached an altitude of 1,000 kilometers and a distance of some 400 kilometers before falling into the Sea of Japan. The UN Security Council, which forbid such tests, met late Wednesday in an emergency session to discuss the North's missile launches. Farhan Haq, a spokesman for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, earlier denounced the firings as a brazen and irresponsible act.
This is a deliberate and grave violation of its international obligations. The continued pursuit by the DPRK of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles will only undermine its security and fail to improve the lives of its citizens. The humanitarian consequences that this would entail cannot be stressed enough. The DPRK must change its course for a denuclearized Korean peninsula.
A White House spokesman said the U.S. strongly condemns what he called the North's provocative actions, said the U.S. would work with its international allies and others like Russia and China about what pressure can be applied. Meanwhile, India launched no fewer than 20 satellites in a single mission Wednesday. The satellites were carried by one rocket that put him into orbit in 26 minutes. In what is seen as a new direction for his presidential campaign, presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump Wednesday unleashed a scathing attack on his likely Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton, saying she may be the most corrupt person ever to seek the White House.
If I'm elected president, I will end the special interest monopoly in Washington, D.C. Very important. The other candidate in this race has spent her entire life making money for special interests, and I will tell you, she's made plenty of money for them, and she's been taking plenty of money out for herself. Hillary Clinton has perfected the politics of personal profit and even theft.
Mrs. Clinton has also been on the attack, warning Trump's policies will be a disaster for the U.S. economy. She said Trump is launching personal attacks because he has no answers on substance. Somalia Wednesday said it killed 8 suspected al-Shabaab militants recovering weapons and munitions during an operation in the central part of the country, an army spokesman telling VOA the operation took place near the town of Masagawa. Russia's President Putin has accused NATO of intensifying rhetoric and boosting its military presence close to the country's borders. Speaking to Russian lawmakers, he said Moscow is ready for dialogue but awaits a positive response from the Western alliance. One of the last two surviving crew members of the so-called Doolittle Raiders has died. Retired Staff Sergeant David Jonathan Thatcher passed away Wednesday at a Montana hospital at age 94 after suffering a stroke. Thatcher, one of 80 airmen who took off in an April 18, 1942 raid from an aircraft carrier bombing Tokyo early in World War II. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, in for James Batty. Today is Thursday, June 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A decision by the Zambia Revenue Authority, ZRA, to close down a leading independent newspaper, The Post, has been called an attempt to muzzle free press in the country.
I got a call personally from the Deputy Minister of Finance, who told me that our writing, our articles were quite vicious and they were damaging to the ruling party. And he asked me if we could tone down.
That is Joseph Mwenda, the deputy managing editor at The Post, an independent newspaper in Zambia. Arrests continue in Burundi after students defaced textbook photos of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Over 500 students in several provinces have been accused and others arrested. And the government of Ethiopia is denying accusations by its neighbor Eritrea that it is planning a military attack on its territory.
No, we're not making any preparation, and we don't have to make any preparation if we have to attack Eritrea. Because last week we have made a proportional response to the provocations of the regime in Asmara, and our troops have withdrawn.
That is Ethiopian Communication Minister Getachew Reda. And the Somali National Army says it killed 8 Al-Shabaab militants and recovered weapons and ammunition during an operation in central Somalia. Those stories, plus Mark Ouma's sports, are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. A decision by the Zambia Revenue Authority to close down the Post newspaper, an independent paper, is aimed at muzzling free press deemed critical of incumbent President Edgar Lungu and his ruling Patriotic Front Party in the run-up to the August 11th general election. This is according to Joseph Mwenda, deputy managing editor and news editor at The Post. The Zambia Revenue Authority shut down operations of the newspaper's printing plant in the capital, Lusaka, late Tuesday night and also closed down its offices. This followed a dispute between the paper and the Revenue Authority over allegations it owed back taxes. Joseph Mwenda is the deputy managing editor and news editor at The Post. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the shutdown has politics written all over it. He says the move was to ensure the newspaper is not published or in circulation between the August 11th presidential, legislative and local elections.
We got some information that they wanted to shut us down because of the independent position that we had taken at the newspaper. All right. I got a call personally. I got a call from the Deputy Minister of Finance. This is Honorable Christopher Mbunga, who told me that, you know, our writing, our articles were quite vicious and they were damaging to the ruling party. And he asked if we could tone down and say that this issue that you have with the ZRA can be taken care of. That's one proof we have that it's really intimidation of the media. They're not after tax. They're after our operations. But we stood our ground. We did not trade to go by the suggestion that was coming from the government. We continue to report as we have always done in the past.
Are you therefore saying that the Zambia Revenue Authority committed an illegality by usurping the powers of the court by enforcing an injunction that is not there by closing down or shutting down your printing press?
It is an illegality, yes. But not only is it an illegality, it's also politics. We are not surprised ourselves because we have evidence that the instructions that are coming from State House are being, you know, implemented by the Zambia Revenue Authority. We can prove that with all the confidence. We have paid most of the money they are claiming, but they just don't want to oblige that. And we have actually showed them that, you know, there's a court order that is restraining them, but they don't want to follow that. What they've done today is to come to the head office where employees gathered outside because the premises was locked. The employees gathered outside, and they fired tear gas at the workers. Chased everybody away, and they were threatening to, you know, to arrest us for an off assembly. We shouldn't be in operation as we go to the election.
So you said you have evidence, the Post newspaper has evidence of attempt to muzzle the press, in this case, the Zambia Post newspaper. What are you going to do with that evidence?
We've gone to court with it. As we speak to you, our lawyers, they've just come out of court. And we are hoping that by tomorrow, the High Court can hear our case, because we feel that this is a clear case of trying to muzzle the press. And they've done it very clearly without any, you know, doubt. We also know the reason why they're doing this, by the way. We also know the reason why they're doing this. This newspaper, you know, has brought out a lot of irregularities in the manner the ruling party is conducting the campaign. The number of people that they've brought on board, foreigners, to come and register to vote in the election. We have produced that evidence as a newspaper that the ruling party has registered hundreds of thousands of foreigners to come and register so that the election can be rigged. On top of that, there are companies that have come from outside this country to come and help the ruling party rig the election. We've brought all those accusations out. They have failed to challenge them because our evidence is overwhelming. So we are a hindrance to to the victory that they are anticipating. That is what this is about. They don't want this newspaper to be around on August 11 when we go to elections.
You think this is a backlash following the exposés that the newspaper brought to the fore about what you said has been plots by the ruling party to rig the vote?
Yes, that's correct. And we have evidence. We have produced the evidence. We have that. We have published that information. In fact, two of our reporters are in court.
Joseph Mwenda is the deputy managing editor and news editor at The Post, an independent newspaper in Zambia. Human rights organizations and various international media watchdogs have condemned the shutdown of The Post. Stephen Ellis, the director of advocacy and communications at the International Press Institute, said that, quote, the misuse of state authority to silence the only major media outlet giving opposition parties a platform can only be seen as an effort to deny voters the information they need to make an informed decision about their future. In the past couple of days, Ethiopia and Eritrea have been accusing each other of starting a border fight. The escalating war of words between the two countries has been of concern to both regional and international observers. Yesterday, a senior advisor to Eritrea's president told a UN hearing that Ethiopia is contemplating full-scale war against Eritrea.
As we speak, Ethiopia is making preparations for a bigger military offensive and is contemplating a full-scale war.
That was Yemane Gebreyab, senior advisor to Eritrea's president. Our colleague Henok Semagzai Fente spoke with Ethiopian Communications Minister Getacha Wereda, who told him there is no preparation for an attack against Eritrea.
No, we're not making any preparation, and we don't have to make any preparation. If we have to attack Eritrea, because last week we have made a proportionate response to the provocations of the regime in Asmara, and our troops have withdrawn back to their positions because there is no need for us to escalate the tension.
Now, we have a senior advisor to Eritrea's President Isaias Afwerki telling the UN that it is no coincidence that the UN report came at the same time border conflicts are simmering between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Let's hear what he had to say.
It's no coincidence that the same week that the Commission released its report saw the worst outbreak of hostilities over the border since the end of the war 16 years ago.
Obviously, Yemane and his government at their wit's end are resorting to conspiracy theories to explain why they find themselves between a rock and a hard place at this point. What they are facing in Geneva is absolutely their own fault. And of course, Ethiopia doesn't have to blame for what these people have done to their people. What the UN Human Rights Council and the Commission of Inquiry are telling the rest of the world is that this government, which has been busy destabilizing the region, has also been equally, if not more frequently, busy mistreating its own people, killing its own people, disappearing its own people, and causing all kinds of problems to its own people. So they better respond to that accusation, to that allegation, which we believe is solidly supported by evidence.
Now let's hear from the chairperson.
That I don't think is going to help.
Now let's hear from the chairperson of the UN Inquiry Commission, Mike Smith, and he in detail explained the findings of the commission.
The commission has concluded that Eritrean officials have committed crimes against humanity. The crimes of enslavement, imprisonment, enforced disappearance, torture, persecution, rape, murder, and other inhumane acts have been committed as part of a widespread and systematic campaign against the civilian population since 1991.
Now, the advisor to Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki, Yemane Gebreyab, made a statement reacting to the inquiry's findings, And basically what he's saying is this is a pretext to an ICC indictment of the Eritrean regime. Let's hear it and I'll take your reaction.
Stepping way over its mandate, the Commission has made the incredible judgment that the human rights situation in Eritrea constitutes a threat to international peace and security as a pretext to send yet another African country to the International Criminal Court.
Now, as a home for the African Union has been opposed to numerous African leaders being sent to the ICC. What's Ethiopian position on this?
Well, African Union has been particularly opposed to ICC targeting African leaders, but it has never supported impunity. It has always called for accountability of leaders for the crimes they commit against their own people. So our position is that any country should be accountable for what it has done to its people.
Now, Eritrea is saying that there is a double standard in this, saying that we're not perfect and we're going through a complete overhaul of the justice system. But there seems to be a double standard. This is what Yamana Garab said. And this is something that's also supported by a number of human rights groups that accuse Ethiopia of human rights violations.
I think Eritreans will all of a sudden assume responsibility for their actions if, for example, by some stroke of magic, the so-called Commission of Inquiry also extends its mandate to Ethiopia. And that's preposterous. Let them respond to the accusations that are leveled against them.
Ethiopian Communications Minister Getachew Reda. Arrests continue in Burundi after students defaced textbook photos of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Over 500 students in several provinces have been accused and five have been arrested. Human Rights Watch reports that earlier this month, Burundian intelligence agents arrested 8 secondary school students in Muramvya province and accused them of insulting the head of state. Subsequent to the arrests, their classmates demonstrated in the streets. Security forces shot and injured 2 students and a motorcycle driver who later died. The students who are facing charges of insulting the head of state face up to 5 years in prison if found guilty. From Burundi's capital Bujumbura, Moses Havyarimana has this report.
The desecration of the president's photos has angered authorities. Some students scribbled over the photos. Others wrote phrases like, get out or not to the third term. The defacing of the photos started in Moravia province and spread to other areas of the country. 11 students in Moravia have been accused and so far 5 have been arrested. They are charged with insulting the head of state. According to Human Rights Watch, some students demonstrated in the streets against the government's handling of the case. 2 were shot and injured by the security forces. Agnes Bagirichenge is the Secretary General of the Supreme Court.
Suite à l'infraction d'outrage envers le chef de l'État commis par certains élèves de 3 établissements secondaires en commune Mouranga.
Agnes says, following the defacing of the president's picture, which was done by some students in the secondary school in Mouravia, that their cases have been opened by the court. She says, the first case includes 6 underage students who went against the law, and the judge provisionally released them, and other 5 will have to face justice. At least 6 out of the 18 provinces have reported the defacing of the textbook photos. Parents are concerned about the ongoing arrests and suspension of students. I talked to one parent in Bujumbura. She says, if something is already done like the way they defaced the president, it was supposed to be handled at the school level. But everything was politicized. They were given a very heavy punishment, and that doesn't exist anywhere else. She says the government didn't confront the problem the right way. As a mother, she says that she is very disappointed that some of those students will miss their third term exams. One of the defense lawyers spoke to me on the phone from Ramve province, where the first incident happened. The lawyer says the children who were arrested are not responsible for defacing the pictures on the textbook, that the textbooks are shared in the different classes, even between different schools, so they were only targeted, and they are not necessarily responsible for the allegations. Last week in Ruyigi province, eastern Burundi, school administrators expelled 230 students when they refused to reveal who scribbled on the president is first in the textbooks. UNICEF's regional director for the Eastern and Southern Africa has expressed concern about the arrests and expulsions from school and injuries of children in Burundi. UNICEF says all children in Burundi have the right to pursue their education and attend the upcoming exams in a neutral, safe and protective environment. Moses Avyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The Nigerian government is eager to find a resolution to months of attacks on its vital oil infrastructure in the Niger Delta. But a ceasefire announced by officials on Tuesday appears to be on shaky ground. Christine reports from Lagos.
A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company, who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity, confirmed the ceasefire deal, but offered no further details. The Niger Delta Avengers militant group said on Twitter no ceasefire had been agreed to. Months of attacks by the Avengers on petroleum infrastructure in the Delta have dropped Nigeria's oil production by as much as half from its usual level of around 2 million barrels per day. Oil is Nigeria's top export. Economists have cited the drop in production as one reason the country's economy, which is Africa's largest, will soon enter a recession. Earlier this month, the government announced it was suspending military operations in the Delta to pave the way for talks. The vice president for Africa operations at intelligence firm Stratfor, Mark Schroeder, says the ceasefire may be a delaying tactic by Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
It could be to buy time while President Buhari has to essentially negotiate or calculate among his other political constituencies, you know, whether he can afford to increase revenue sharing with the Niger Delta region.
The Southern Delta region is home to almost all of Nigeria's oil production, but remains deeply impoverished. Militancy is nothing new there. A similar insurgency raged until 2009, when the government started paying off fighters and giving them job training in exchange for their halting attacks. The Avengers, a mysterious group that communicates primarily through a Twitter account, could not be reached for comment. In a statement last week, the Avengers demanded the federal government commit to independently mediated talks. The confusion over the truce's existence may be a sign of factionalism within the Avengers, Schroeder said, or it may just be impatience with the Buhari administration. Much of what the group is demanding are resolutions to long-standing grievances in the Delta.
What they want to see above all is some reasonable offer of engagement by the Buhari government.
The Avengers' most recent attack was June 16th. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Forces loyal to Libya's new national unity government in Tripoli have reportedly made gains inside the Islamic State-held coastal city of Sirte, while forces loyal to the rival government in Tobruk say they have pushed back al-Qaeda militants in Benghazi. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Militiamen loyal to the unity government captured two districts inside Sirte amid heavy fighting and reports of casualties on both sides. Ahmed Hadia, a spokesman for pro-government military forces in Sirte, told Libyan TV that battles took place in several areas.
قوات البنيان المرصوص حققت تقدما على جميع المحاور في الزعفران والغربيات.
He says pro-government militiamen had pushed IS fighters out of the Zafran and Garbiat districts and quartered them in small pockets of the 700 district and the Ouagadougou conference center. Islamic State fighters were reported to be fighting fiercely despite recent losses, using car bombs, suicide attackers, and other booby-trapped objects. A government military commander in Sirte told journalists that IS fighters had booby-trapped vehicles and shops to stop the government advance into the city. The Libya Herald newspaper reported that 170 pro-government militiamen have been killed and over 700 injured since the start of the military operation dubbed Bunyan al-Marsous to retake Sirte. The paper added that many of the casualties in the fighting were taken to Misrata Central Hospital, where doctors refused to allow journalists to take photos. It indicated that many of the wounded had suffered horrific injuries and that conditions at the hospital were poor because of shortages of drugs, antibiotics, and even nurses.
Allez, allez, allez.
Arab media also reported heavy fighting inside Libya's second largest city of Benghazi as forces loyal to the government in Tobruk fought to expel Islamic militants loyal to al-Qaeda. Heavy clashes against militants took place in the nearby port of Ajdabiya several days ago. A spokesman for Libyan military units in the east of the country, loyal to Army Commander Khalifa Haftar, told journalists that his forces were advancing against the militants near the district of Sabri and Souq al-Hout near Benghazi. The Libyan army has made similar claims of gains against militants in Benghazi in the past. Forces loyal to General Haftar have also carried out airstrikes against Islamic militant positions near Ajdabiya and the eastern militant stronghold of Darna in recent days. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
In Uganda, it's common to bring women into households to help with chores such as cleaning, cooking, and childcare. Yet many say they have been coerced into undergoing screening for HIV and sexually transmitted infections. Advocates say the testing is a harbinger of discrimination and even sexual exploitation. Elizabeth Pulat reports from Kampala.
Most middle-class homes in Uganda hire some form of house help, but domestic workers are increasingly being required to submit to health screenings as a precondition to employment. Domestic workers and labor advocates say women are routinely tested for sexually transmitted infections, including HIV. Lydia Bwiti, a lawyer with the Platform for Labor Action, investigates rights abuses for workers in Uganda.
Even those who say, yes, I consented, it is a forceful thing. And we have always encouraged our domestic workers for their own benefit, without even forcing them to go and test for their HIV. Remain with your results. It is up to you. Mm-hmm. When you find out, please look after yourself appropriately. But when you drive me from your home, take me to a clinic, and you test me, you actually want me to look at my results, but the consent is not there.
Staff at clinics that administer tests confirmed this phenomenon, but said they weren't authorized to be interviewed. Several employers also declined to speak on microphone, but told VOA that they demand the screenings because they want to know if someone around their child has HIV. Yet dismissal rather than healthcare is often the result of a positive test. The clinics acknowledge that the patient's consent is required to disclose test results, but some domestic workers here are under the legal age of consent, and many do not speak English. The 2014 HIV and AIDS Prevention and Control Act makes disclosing an HIV status to anybody but the patient illegal. It also prohibits workplace discrimination based on HIV status. HIV is transmitted via direct contact with bodily fluids of an infected person. HIV is not transmitted via casual contact. Benin Kasinji, an undersecretary with the Ministry of Gender, Labor and Social Development, says that health screenings for domestic workers can be a red flag for sexual exploitation.
Many times those people are accused in courts of being available to the men in the house. And the ladies, therefore, would want to see if it ever happened. Maybe, God forbid, I shouldn't pick up the STI or the HIV AIDS from her. So I would consider that an abuse.
Miriam, who has been a nanny for 7 years, says that when she was tested, the results went directly to her employer. Although she had a clean bill of health, a former colleague wasn't so lucky.
Like, for example, one of the nanny was tested. I think it was her second year. Then she was taken for a test. Then they found she was HIV positive. And you know the bosses, they meet their friends. So the boss started spreading her name. So and so is like this. Now it is difficult for her to get a job because they know she's already HIV positive. Now she got treatment, she's okay, but because her name was spoiled that she's like this and this, she can't be employed anywhere. She's one of our friends, but there's no way we can help her.
That fear of receiving a bad reputation also keeps women from reporting sexual abuse.